This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. I'm coming to you live from our studio in Edmond. This morning on today's show, we're going to tackle a difficult subject, the scandal that has hit the Roman Catholic Church. This 1,400-page grand jury report was released a couple of weeks ago, accusing some 300 priests in Pennsylvania of abusing children over a 70-year period. And the investigation revealed that several Catholic priests and church officials were aware of the abuse and covered up the crime. And then this past weekend, the scandal took a dramatic turn that implicates Pope Francis himself. We're going to hear a report later on in the program from trumpet writer Richard Palmer. And at the end of the show, I'm going to give you a bit of sound, simple, rock-solid advice on what to put in your mouth. But we're going to start the program in Venezuela. This South American nation is in terrible straits. It's suffering one of the worst cases of hyperinflation in history. Last month, inflation was 83,000%. Prices have been doubling every 26 days. I saw a report on NBC News, a series of pictures that they published of the huge stacks of paper money that is required to buy just simple everyday items, to buy a chicken or a tomato or a roll of toilet paper. The money is worthless. Last week, the country took the desperate step of devaluing its currency, the bolivar, by 95%. It just lopped five zeros off the exchange rate, and it renamed the currency the sovereign bolivar. So every 100,000 bolivars become just one sovereign bolivar. Imagine, say, having a bank account with several hundred thousand bolivars and having your savings reduced to single digits of this new currency. But they aren't changing any of the underlying economic problems that created this crisis. So all through Venezuela, you have cities that are experiencing water shortages and electricity cuts. There are massive food shortages. The average Venezuelan lost 18 pounds in 2016 and 24 pounds last year. Child malnutrition is at a record high. Last year, nearly 400 children starved to death. Venezuela's economic meltdown has also caused a terrible upsurge in organized crime. The food shortages, the unemployment, the hyperinflation, these economic problems have made it almost impossible to earn a living legally. So in some areas, the family needs the equivalent of 22 minimum wage salaries just to buy a basic basket of food. So what do people do? Well, they earn money by engaging with the only free market there is in Venezuela, and that's the black market. According to a report by Insight Crime, Venezuela is now a mafia state. Nearly everybody does business with the black markets on some level. Fathers smuggle gasoline and other contraband into Brazil and Colombia. Teachers and doctors and petroleum engineers are selling their bodies in prostitution and drug trafficking. Gangs are recruiting teenagers by offering them something to eat. Even many government officials now do business with gangs and drug cartels and terrorist networks, so it makes it hard to tell who's a government worker and who's a criminal. And people are fleeing the country in droves. Just since 2014, 2.3 million people have left the country. That's nearly 7.5% of the population. That would be like over 24 million Americans leaving this country in a massive exodus. This refugee crisis is the biggest crisis in the Western Hemisphere right now. What's happening in Venezuela is an absolute disaster. Well, why is it happening? What happened in this nation? Venezuela is rich with resources, with gold and diamonds and minerals. It has the largest oil reserves in the world. It has the means to become extremely prosperous. In fact, Venezuela used to be extremely prosperous. In 1950, it had the fourth largest per capita income in the world after the United States, Switzerland, and New Zealand. In 1980, it had the fastest growing economy in the world. Even as late as 2001, it was still the wealthiest country in Latin America. In 2012, just 6 years ago, Venezuela's GDP hit a high of $18,382 per person. So what happened? This is such an important question that the Western world should be looking at very closely, because some of the same ideas, some of the same policies that have destroyed Venezuela are being praised. And they're being considered, and in some cases even implemented, within the United States. It doesn't take much digging to learn exactly what happened to Venezuela. In 1998, the Venezuelan people elected a democratic socialist to run their nation, Hugo Rafael Chavez Frias. He won Venezuela's presidential election with 56% of the vote. Despite the nation's wealth, because of government corruption and mismanagement, the poverty rate at that time was an incredible 50%. Half the country was in poverty. And Chavez promised to end government corruption. He promised to give Venezuela's wealth to the impoverished masses, to give the power to the people. He said, Venezuela is a nation of great wealth, but it's being stolen from its citizens by the evil capitalists and the evil corporations. Chavez was extremely popular. He was very charismatic. He appeared on television for hours at a time. Really, people loved him. And most importantly, he gave so much to the poor. Luckily for him, rising oil prices brought a tremendous amount of wealth into the country. Venezuela is almost entirely dependent on oil for its exports. So fluctuations in the oil price mean the difference between massive wealth and near poverty. And Chavez enjoyed the former. And that made him look like a benevolent genius to his people. He took his nation's oil money, which amounted to about $1 trillion over the 14 years that he was president, and he put that money into massive social programs. And on top of that, his government nationalized thousands of private companies and industries. Chavez said that the government would run these businesses better than private owners would, and then they would share the profits with the people. So the poverty rate went down from 50% to about 32% by the time of Chavez's reelection in 2006. Poverty went down. His popularity went up. He got almost two-thirds of the vote in that election, 2006. And what was happening in Venezuela was hailed as a real victory for 21st century socialism. And Chavez was praised by liberals all over the Western world. The examples are just about endless. I'll just give you a few. Filmmaker Oliver Stone made a documentary called My Friend Hugo. And in a press conference in Venezuela's capital city in 2010, Oliver Stone vehemently defended Chavez. He said, look at the positive changes that have happened economically, that have happened in all of South America because of Chavez. Jeremy Corbyn, he's the current leader of the British Labour Party. He said this in 2009, Venezuela is seriously conquering poverty by emphatically rejecting the neoliberal policies of the world's financial institutions. Bernie Sanders, the Democratic presidential candidate, who's an avowed socialist himself, he posted an article, a 2011 article on his website that was labeled Must Read. And that article said this, these days the American dream is more apt to be realized in South America, in places such as Ecuador, Venezuela, and Argentina, where incomes are actually more equal today than they are in America. Noam Chomsky, he praised Chavez for a historic liberation of Latin America. He said that Chavez freed Latin America from 500 years of Western force that went back to the time of the conquistadors. They had a lot of nice things to say about Chavez, about Venezuela, about the policies that Chavez had implemented there and the effects that they were having. But as they were praising him and as they were celebrating this supposed miracle in Venezuela, there were some signs that not all was right in this socialist paradise. People overlooked these things. But to enact these reforms, Chavez took control of all branches of power, the executive, the legislative, the judicial, the military. He eliminated the nation's Congress. He replaced it with a National Assembly, which he controlled. And he used this body to rewrite the nation's constitution in order to guarantee that he could stay in power. They increased the length of the presidential terms. They got rid of term limits. He stacked the Supreme Court with his own followers. He fired anybody that he didn't like at the government-owned oil company, and he replaced them with people who were loyal to himself. He effectively destroyed the private sector by confiscating or expropriating industry after industry. And these moves were popular. But there's a problem. As much as people tend to like some of the short-term effects of a socialist government, there's another side to it. When you give people in government that much control, that much power, there's another side. As former U.S. President Gerald Ford once said, a government big enough to give you everything you want is a government big enough to take from you everything you have. And sure enough, in this socialist paradise, under the much-loved Hugo Chavez, the people began to have some of their freedoms forcibly taken away. When journalists began criticizing the president, he had them arrested. When judges ruled against his decisions, Chavez had them arrested. When people protested, they were arrested. Some of them were even shot in the street. And when military officers began to grow uncomfortable with these heavy-handed tactics, Chavez brought in spies from communist Cuba to keep an eye on them. In 2010, Transparency International labeled Chavez's Venezuela the most corrupt country in Latin America. And this is a continent with quite a few corrupt countries. But still, there was this tremendous cash flow coming into the government because oil was still selling for $100 a barrel. And when elections rolled around again in 2012, Chavez was reelected. The difference was that in this election, there were no international election observers, and there was evidence of rigging. It's amazing how often in history these revolutionaries who promise to give power to the people never seem to let power go once they have it. Now, it just so happened that soon after that election, Chavez contracted cancer. He went to Cuba for treatment, and, you know, under the wonderful healthcare system of Cuba that's been praised by so many liberals in America, he died. That was in March 2013. Conveniently for him, this was when the oil money was still rolling in, and it was before the real reckoning for his reckless policies came due. Chavez was replaced by his hand-picked successor, Nicolas Maduro. And within 1 year, the inevitable happened. The price of oil plummeted. Oil revenues shrank, and suddenly the real costs of Chavez's socialist policies became obvious. Margaret Thatcher once said, "The trouble with socialism is that eventually you run out of other people's money." And that's exactly what has happened under Nicolas Maduro. Since 2012, when the GDP per capita reached its high of 18,382, it has contracted 34%. The national economy shrank 16% in 2016 and 14% more last year. This year, it's expected to shrink 15% further. this nation has gone from being the world's fourth wealthiest nation to being 131st on that list. Inflation was 112% in 2015. It ballooned to 2,800% last year. And the International Monetary Fund projects that inflation could reach 1,000,000% by the end of this year. Ruling over this wreck of a nation, Maduro is determined to hold on to power. He won his election in 2013 with 51% of the vote, and that election was probably rigged. And at that time, the poverty rate was still around 32%. This year, with the poverty rate soaring at 77%, somehow Maduro was reelected with 68% of the vote. So after 5 years of disaster and economic catastrophe and social upheaval, somehow the president's popularity rose by one-third. That is really odd, really alarming, except when you consider that, again, they didn't allow international election observers, and the British company that provided the voting machine said there was at least a million vote discrepancy between actual voter participation and the statistic announced by the Venezuelan authorities. Again, we have a strong man using authoritarian tactics to cling to power. Maduro is using his security forces to crack down on protesters and journalists. The Bolivarian National Guard have arrested people just for filming people who are standing outside supermarkets each day because of the food shortages. And meanwhile, the press reports say Hugo Chavez's daughter has accumulated a fortune estimated at $4.2 billion. So it turned out that electing a democratic socialist to end corruption, to share the nation's wealth, to give power to the people, it didn't work out so well. It ended up being very undemocratic. It didn't end corruption. And after a short period, thanks to high oil prices, it made the nation far poorer. And it gave the people even less power. It's so important to look at this example squarely, because right now in America, socialism is gaining enormous acceptance. A Gallup poll from August 13th says 51% of young Americans aged 18 to 29 have a positive view of socialism. 51%. Positive view of socialism compared to only 45% who view free markets positively. Stephen Fleury talked about this on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show last week, the Bernie Sanders movement that received such support from these young people in the last presidential election. Well, now that movement is finding success in state primaries, and some of these candidates, they're going to make their way into the U.S. Congress and gubernatorial offices around the country. There was another big election in Florida yesterday that pushed one of these individuals that Bernie Sanders endorses into contention for the governorship. Elizabeth Warren is proposing nationalizing every major business in America. Every business worth $1 billion or more. This is the senior senator from Massachusetts. She's a Harvard Law School professor, a scholar in bankruptcy law, one of the finest minds that our education and political system can produce, the way the world would view it, a leading figure in the Democratic Party. She's on the news all the time. And essentially, she's looking at what Chavez did in Venezuela and saying, that's what we want for America. Many Americans are saying effectively, we need to look at nations like Venezuela as a model for how to gain universal health care, how to have universal education, free college tuition, massive minimum wage increases. We need to redistribute the wealth. We need to correct these economic imbalances in society. We need to force the rich to take care of the poor. Now, you can make all of those ideas sound noble. But the problem is that human beings have been trying these ideas for all of our history, and they have failed. again and again and again. And in this case, we have a spectacular failure that occurred right under our noses. And it's happening right now. You don't even have to read a history book to see what's happening. All you have to do is pay attention and just learn the lessons that are so plain. But if you do look at history, you see this pattern of failure time after time after time. The gap between rich and poor is always there. And generally, it's because people have different levels of ability, and those who can produce end up having more. Wealth always tends to get concentrated in a minority. History shows, well, that often leads the majority to get restless, to get upset, and in many cases to revolt. And so often you have leaders rise up who promise to redistribute the wealth. And if they get power, they'll do that. They'll do that for a while. And you may even have the general standard of living rise for a short time. But the problem is moving wealth around doesn't create more wealth. Production creates more wealth. And giving people money doesn't make them more productive. It tends to make them less productive. And taking wealth from the producers tends to make them less productive too. And the more violent the revolution, the more wealth is destroyed in that process. So the upshot of these kinds of revolutions tends to be a general loss of wealth, a general loss of productivity. And once that redistributed wealth is spent, then poverty comes roaring back with a vengeance. And this isn't just a 20th century phenomenon. This has happened throughout human history. I want to read to you something that Pulitzer Prize-winning historians Will and Ariel Durant wrote in their book, The Lessons of History. They said, "The experience of the past leaves little doubt that every economic system must sooner or later rely upon some form of the profit motive to stir individuals and groups to productivity. Substitutes like slavery, police supervision, or ideological enthusiasm prove too unproductive, too expensive, or too transient. Normally and generally, men are judged by their ability to produce." Now, this is somebody who, I mean, Will and Ariel Durant, they produced an 11-volume set of history books, The History of Civilization, that they won the Pulitzer Prize for. And this is one of the big lessons that they took from studying all of that history. And this is a lesson that socialists do not understand. This is a fundamental truth of human nature taught by millennia of human experience. Socialists don't get it. But God understands it. God knows human nature. That's why God's word says in 2 Thessalonians 3:10, if anyone doesn't work, neither should he eat. That's why God commands in 1 Timothy 5:8 that the head of each family provide for his own, especially those of his own house, not to rely on government social programs to provide. This is why the economic system of the Bible is based on every family living on their own land, under their own vine and their own fig tree, and taking responsibility for themselves. This is why God says, we all eat the fruit of our doings, and every man receives his own reward according to his own labor. And God rewards every man according to his works and renders to every man according to his deeds, and that every one of us shall give account of himself. Because of that law of human nature, or that truth about our human nature, when a government decides to take from the wealthy and give to the poor, it ignores these basic biblical commands and truths. We ignore the wisdom God gave us to help us order society for everyone's benefit. That's why God gave us that truth. And we rely on our own reasoning. We do what seems right in our own eyes. Every time we do that, it creates problems rather than solving them. It creates problems that are worse than what they were to start with. It might look good for a short time. It did under Chavez. But the reckoning always comes. Americans live under an economic system that has done more to eliminate poverty than any other system in history. A system that has created more wealth than any other in history. A system that has lifted millions upon millions of people out of poverty to a standard of living higher than any other people have enjoyed in history. That is remarkable. And yet something is drawing us to socialism. Why can't we just believe God? Why can't we just obey God? And there's another very troubling aspect to what's happening in Venezuela that we must not ignore, and that is the way that this supposedly democratic socialist government has transformed into an authoritarian government. This is another pernicious aspect of human nature, the fact that when you give a leader or a government that kind of power, the power to control the economy to that degree, and to take from these people and to give to those people, this is what it leads to. So often, over and over again, in socialist nations, rulers use democracy to come to power. They amass that power to implement their reforms, and they never let go. Most democratic socialist revolutions throughout history end up becoming authoritarian. Many of them turn into full-blown dictatorships. They say it's all about helping the people, but really what they want is power. And whether or not people want to admit it, this is exactly what is motivating this movement within the United States. Nationalizing healthcare, nationalizing all billion-dollar businesses, higher taxes, taking from the wealthy so that politicians can distribute that money the way they believe is just, so they can give people all kinds of benefits, so they can give people free college education in these institutions that teach new generations of scholars about the glories of Marxism. This isn't about equality. This is a massive power grab. Just like Hugo Chavez, they think that the problems in the free market can be solved if you just take power from private enterprise and you give that power to the government. We can run these companies better than the private sector can, as if only people in the private sector operate out of self-interest, whereas those in the government are pure and altruistic and they're totally trustworthy to do everything in the public interest. They have no human nature, and the more power they have, the better off we all are. That's really the thinking. And that type of thinking is totally contrary to the government established by America's founders, and it's been progressively infecting Washington for over a century and causing the government to grow bigger and bigger and bigger and concentrating more and more power in Washington and turning this nation into something very different from what the founders intended. And people like Elizabeth Warren think that the government doesn't yet have enough power. What she's proposing, if that actually happened, that would be the largest seizure of private property in human history. That type of thinking is totally contrary, not just to the founders' vision for America, but it is totally opposed to the wisdom of the Bible. If you study the biblical model for government, you see a system that is very lean. A system that gives individuals and families a tremendous amount of economic freedom and personal freedom. The governments of socialist nations, they claim taxes 60, 70, 80, 90% of the income of the people. God's government is able to operate on people paying a flat tax of 10%, the tithing system. And that gives you an idea of how lean God's government is. The big government socialist model ignores that wisdom. They ignore the fact that everyone has human nature. Everyone has human nature, including government officials. And when you give people too much power, corruption almost inevitably flourishes. The government wants everyone looking to them to take care of them. and to solve all the problems. God says, cursed is the man who trusts in man. God wants to help all people learn responsibility, take responsibility, to work and to learn and to grow and to learn to look to him for our help and to trust him. Blessed is the man who trusts in the Lord and whose help the Lord is. Why can't we just believe God and obey God? What powerful lessons we need to learn from what is happening in Venezuela right now. Something is very wrong with the thinking in America today. We are unteachable. We won't learn the lessons of history, and we won't even learn the lessons of this neighboring nation that is happening right before our faces. We reject those lessons because we're too convinced of our own wisdom. We're too certain that we know how to make things work, that even if they had problems taking a certain course of action, we won't make those mistakes. That is terrible ignorance, terrible naivety, terrible arrogance. No matter how disastrous the failures are, no matter how consistent the failures are, the defenders of the socialist ideology, they say, well, you know, they did some things right. Well, they took it too far in this or that detail. Or it would have worked if they'd have just done this or that differently. That wasn't a real socialist system. Real socialism hasn't been tried yet. You can't name a single example of socialism that was successful in the long term. It always goes off the rails. And it's not because the leaders just got some details wrong or they had some personal flaws. It's because the system is fundamentally flawed, because the system throws out God's wisdom. It throws out the Bible. It trusts in man. It trusts in human reasoning, and it will never, ever work. What will it take to make us teachable? Well, the Bible tells us the answer. It shows that our unteachability and our rejection of God is going to have terrifying consequences, worse than what's happening in Venezuela. A time of suffering unlike any in human history. That's what it'll take before we realize the folly in our own thinking. But thankfully, we will realize it, and God will be able at last to teach us. If you want to learn more about God's economic system and God's system of government, if you want a vision of just how wonderful the world will be when this system is implemented, I'd encourage you to read our article by Trumpet executive editor Stephen Fleury. It's called A New World Economy. And also, The Wonderful World Tomorrow, this booklet by Herbert W. Armstrong. This is a wonderful booklet that you can read online, or we'll send you a free copy. The Wonderful World Tomorrow. Go to the Trumpet Hour Hub at thetrumpet.com for links to this article and this booklet, and you will gain a wonderful vision of a future of prosperity for everyone based on the law of God.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Scandal is plaguing the Roman Catholic Church as hundreds of priests have been accused of sexual abuse and high-ranking officials accused of covering up their crimes over a period of decades. This past weekend, the man at the top was implicated, as we'll learn in this report from Richard Palmer.
The Catholic Church is facing its biggest crisis in centuries, and that's not an exaggeration. The Catholic Church has been facing its child abuse scandal crisis since around 2002, when a lot of these allegations started to get a lot of publicity. However, many more allegations against the Catholic Church and against Catholic priests and bishops have come out in just the last few weeks, and the scandal took a dramatic turn over the weekend and is now engulfing the Pope himself. So the present stage in this scandal began a fortnight ago, when a 1,400-page grand jury report was published that accused 300 Catholic priests in Pennsylvania of abusing children over a period of 70 years. This was a result of an extensive investigation, and it identified 1,000 children that had been abused. However, the report concluded that the real number of children abused was in the thousands, so far more than just 1,000. The report is hard to read. It documents as the abuse of innocent children, some as young as 18 months. And it goes, and it, well, it chronicles the painful effects of this long-term abuse, where these young people, scarred by their abuse at the hand of a priest or a nun, turn to drugs, alcohol, even suicide, as they tried to deal with what had happened to them. The investigation also revealed that several Catholic priests and church officials knew about the abuse and covered it up. Pennsylvania's Attorney General Josh Shapiro, he wrote that the pattern was abuse, deny, and cover-up. He called it a systematic cover-up by senior church officials. The jury report said showed some very senior Catholic Church officials in Pennsylvania knew about the abuse and did nothing. They were more focused on protecting the abusers and the reputation of the Catholic Church than those children. And over the weekend, there was a dramatic publication of a memo showing just how high the cover-up goes. Archbishop Carlo Maria Vigano, he's the former, well, basically the nuncio, the former Vatican ambassador to the United States. And he, in an 11-page memo or letter, he revealed that he had informed Pope Francis about one of the most prominent priests there that was accused of sexual abuse. And having been informed about what was going on, he said that Pope Francis did nothing. He said that he'd spoken with Pope Francis about Cardinal Theodore McCarrick, a former Archbishop of Washington, and there are allegations of abuse, that he abused boys going back years and years. Vigano said that he had warned the Pope about McCarrick's behavior, that he had informed him of an order that Pope Benedict XVI had given to McCarrick to withdraw to a life of prayer and penitence. He said that Pope Francis knew from at least June 2013 that he was a serial predator. The Archbishop wrote, he knew that he, McCarrick, was a corrupt man, but he covered for him to the bitter end. Vigano said that he told Pope Francis that McCarrick had corrupted generations of seminarians and priests. However, Vigano said the Pope did not make the slightest comment about those very grave words of mine and did not show any expression of surprise on his face, as if he had already known the matter for some time and immediately changed the subject. And Vigano went as far as calling on the Pope to resign over this issue. He said Pope Francis must be the first to set a good example to cardinals and bishops who covered up McCarrick's abusers and resign along with all of them. So a senior church official calling on the Pope to resign. Veteran Vatican journalist Rocco Palmo, he wrote that Vigano's memo can only be described as nuclear, to say nothing of fresh fuel to the burgeoning crisis. He said that even before this memo had come out, that several key U.S. prelates had privately told him that the coming storm was already worse than 2002, because this time it's about the bishops. Damian Thompson, another longtime religious commentator or journalist focusing on Catholic affairs, he wrote for The Spectator yesterday, it's very hard to overstate the gravity of the crisis facing the Pope and members of the senior hierarchy of the United States today. They have been implicated in an alleged conspiracy to protect a sex criminal. The charges made by Vigano are so extensive and so serious that legal proceedings arising from them are likely to be on a gigantic scale and will take years rather than months to address. Long before they are concluded, there is a strong possibility that the pontificate of Jorge Mario Bergoglio, the Argentinian who took the name of Pope Francis, will have come to a spectacular and disastrous end. It's not really surprising that the Pope would know about these allegations. Cardinal George Pell has been referred to as the Vatican number three. He's head of the Vatican's finances. He's one of the group of 8 or 9 papal advisors specially selected by this Pope himself. And he's currently standing trial in Australia for multiple historic sexual offences. He's already been found complicit in cover-ups of sexual abuse by the Australian Royal Commission into Institutional Responses to Child Sex Abuse. Now, this report or this statement from Archbishop Vigano came out while the Pope was visiting Ireland, a nation that's still reeling from its own abuse allegations. In 2009, for example, after a 9-year investigation, there was a report published by Ireland's Commission to Inquire into Child Abuse, and it revealed that sexual abuse was endemic in boys' institutions run by the Catholic Church. It basically found that Ireland at this time was only slightly short of a theocracy. The Catholic Church was charged with looking after and educating all sorts of children, from homeless to ones that were taken away from divorced mothers against their will. It was tasked and paid for by the government to look after all sorts of endangered people. And the church basically used them as slave labor and sent as much of the money that they got from the government back to Rome that they were being paid to look after these people. And then on top of that, there was just this massive sexual abuse of all of those in their care. The Pope, while he was in Ireland, he received a much softer or less warm welcome than was expected. 500,000 tickets had already been given out to come and see the Pope's Mass on Sunday, and the pictures showed dramatically fewer than that turned out. You can compare the pictures of the last time, way back in the 70s or 80s, when a Pope visited Ireland, and it was masses thronging the streets. This time, as the Pope traveled through Dublin, it was nothing like that. So what happens now? Will Pope Francis resign? Will there be another papal election? Will somehow Benedict XVI come back and replace him? Well, these are now questions that are being asked and circulated. And perhaps more significantly, where does the Vatican and the Catholic Church go from here? And these crimes, the behavior of the Pope, the scandal that's just getting bigger and bigger, that's going to damage the reputation of the Catholic leaders and perhaps even the religion itself. And this is an important story to watch. Both history and the Bible show that there are going to be big changes coming to the Vatican and the Catholic Church. Historically, the Vatican has been a powerful force in world politics. Popes have had the power to make kings and governments, to bring peace treaties together, to give instructions to nations around the world. When the Pope speaks, hundreds of millions listen and respond. So this means that who the Pope is, his character, you know, all of this matters not just to Catholics, but to the whole world. Now, the Bible doesn't tell you exactly what's going to happen here or who the next Pope will be, but it does provide a lot of insight into the future of the Catholic Church and the Vatican. Isaiah 47 and Revelation 17 both talk about the Vatican in this end time. They reveal that it will be a powerful, influential force in world events, especially within the unification of Europe, and that Catholicism will be the primary spiritual influence behind this new power that's rising in Europe. Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry wrote about this in 2005. He wrote that the Pope will come to actually guide European affairs in a powerful way. European leaders will soon realize that if they want to be in power, they will have to gain the support of the Pope. They will actually become subservient to him. This is what the Bible prophesies. The infusion of religion into European affairs is the missing ingredient that will vault the continent to superpower prominence. There's been a lot of significant and prophetically significant outcomes from Pope Francis's time in office. But the Bible indicates that this next pope, or the final pope, is going to be different. It indicates he could be more conservative and traditional. He'll certainly be more aggressive and assertive. He won't be afraid to tackle sensitive issues or involve himself in geopolitics, especially in Europe. And as you see Pope Francis struggling like this, you have to wonder, is the final pope about to appear?
Well, thank you for that, Richard. There's obviously a lot to this story that is deeply troubling. You have to
feel bad for the many hundreds or even thousands of victims of these crimes. I saw one report where they had video interviews of some of the victims. It was just heartbreaking to see how much their lives have been destroyed by what's happened here. But as you talked about, our interest in this story goes beyond just that. We keep a close eye on the Vatican because of how prominently the Catholic Church features in some of the most important prophecies of the Bible. You talked a bit about what sort of pope we would expect to see at the very end based on prophecy. Can you just talk a bit about what Pope Francis has accomplished, even if he proves not to be the last pope, as you say? How has he moved Bible prophecy forward in some ways?
Well, I think one of the big prophecies that we talk about the Catholic Church is its role as a peacemaker, as not necessarily a genuine peacemaker, but one that has an influence in world events, that is kind of a go-to power for people to negotiate. And I think he's done a lot to push that forward, most significantly with Cuba. Mm-hmm. It really is amazing when you look into the details of Cuba, and you've got like secret letters from the Pope being passed to the American president with, this is what you should do. You can come, all of those negotiations happening in the Vatican itself. So you've just, even Cuba by itself is a big deal, where it's opening up Cuba now for foreign powers to move in, and it's this massive island base just off America's kind of soft underbelly.
Mm-hmm.
So that's significant. And then, like I said, this Pope's reputation as a peacemaker. He's done similar in Colombia, where he's helped people negotiate with the terrorists there and helped somebody get a Nobel Peace Prize. So he's kind of increased the Vatican stature in world events. I think he's also done a lot to really attack capitalism and the U.S. financial system. He's really kind of popularized this idea that free markets are morally evil. It's something that you see everywhere now with the rise in the left, the Occupy Wall Street type movements mm-hmm. that we saw, the common demonization of the 1%. But he's really helped broaden that and create this kind of feeling worldwide that America's financial system and the American dominated financial system is immoral, and then B, we need a new financial system. And then I think also with just kind of this softer, more liberal image of the Catholic Church, some of his reforms on things like divorce and remarriage have been hugely controversial within the Catholic Church, but they've made it easier for some of these Protestant groups to move toward unity with the Catholic Church.
Hmm.
And so he's really pushed, you look at how he's worked with the Lutherans in this big, I think it was the 500th anniversary of the Protestant Reformation. He's really moved the Catholic Church towards unity with a lot of these different Protestant groups. And that's something that is specifically forecast in some of those scriptures I mentioned towards the end of the report there, in places like Isaiah 47, that the Catholic Church would bring back in its daughter churches.
Mm-hmm.
So I think several very important, significant things that Pope Francis has done.
Well, it's very good that you're covering this. I'm glad that this is being focused on in thetrumpet.com. I'm sure there's going to be a lot more to report on in the time ahead as this unfolds. This really could be a major inflection point for the Catholic Church. If people wanted more information about this, there's obviously a lot of prophecies that this touches on, but it really is central to for people to understand this. Where do you think would be good resources to direct people to?
Well, you can get our free book, The Holy Roman Empire in Prophecy. That has a huge amount of history on the Catholic Church, and goes through 2,000 years of Catholic history. And then it shows how so much of that history was prophesied very specifically and in great detail in the Bible. It's a tremendous study for proving the Bible's accuracy in forecasting history and world events. And then it goes beyond what is recorded history to show, well, what the Bible says about what is coming as well. So it's a great key to understanding the history and the future of this institution.
Well, thank you for that. We've been talking with trumpet writer Richard Palmer about the sex abuse scandals facing the Catholic Church. He's written an article with Brad McDonald, the title, The Nuclear Memo That Could Bring Down Pope Francis. You can find that on the front page of thetrumpet.com. Thank you very much, Richard.
Have a good afternoon.
It's time for today's last word.
Confused by all the conflicting advice on food and nutrition out there? Don't be. At its heart, healthy eating is simple. Here's one rock-solid nutritional principle. As much as possible, eat foods that God created you to eat the way He created them. God created us to need food, and He created food to fulfill that need. He made our bodies to benefit the most from food that is in the form He created it. Man can't make anything that God made any better. For example, God made apples. An apple is a wonderful food. Ingredients list, apple. If you want to make apples more of a treat, make applesauce. Just slice the apples, cook them for about 8 hours, season them if you want it to with cinnamon or nutmeg, puree, and enjoy. Food manufacturers, however, are more concerned with selling food than with our health, and they'll use anything they can to make their food look better, taste better, last longer, and even unnaturally make you crave more. Mott's Healthy Harvest Summer Strawberry Applesauce has these ingredients: apples, water, high fructose corn syrup, strawberry puree, sugar, natural flavor, ascorbic acid, red 40. That is a not-so-wonderful food. As much as possible, avoid processed refined foods, refined sugar, white flour, refined vegetable oils, canned foods, unless you do your own canning, condensed milk, pasteurized milk, skim and low-fat milk, hydrogenated fats, additives, and artificial sweeteners. Most of these are loaded with chemicals, preservatives, taste enhancers, and colorings that God did not create for us to consume. People have created them to sell food and make money. A simple rule of thumb to remember is if it's in a can or a box that came out of a factory, it probably comes with problems. Read nutrition labels. Many of them contain a long list of unpronounceable ingredients that come from chemistry laboratories, not grandma's kitchen, even though it may say grandma's kitchen on the front. Emulsifiers, polysorbate 20, potassium propionate, azotocarbonamide enzymes, propylene glycol, alginate, and so on. As you're reading labels, consider this. The United States Food and Drug Administration currently permits manufacturers to add 93 ingredients to bread products without even mentioning them on the nutrition label. If you do buy something that comes in a box or a can, choose items with fewer ingredients. If it has more than 6 ingredients, try to find something else. Ingredients that you can pronounce and recognize are better for you. Modern food production has created a lot of allergies. Food sensitivities and allergies can wreak havoc on your system. You might be suffering from food allergies without realizing it, so you're hurting yourself every time you unknowingly eat an allergen. This even extends to basic foods that God created but that have been processed by food factories, especially these items: milk, eggs, wheat, soy, peanuts, tree nuts such as almonds, cashews, and walnuts, and fish like bass, cod, and flounder. If you are often unwell, try getting off all these ingredients and see how you feel. Then add them back one at a time to see which one makes you worse. A basic rule that educator Herbert W. Armstrong promoted was, eat only those natural foods that will spoil and eat them before you do. If you keep this in mind, you'll eat far less refined food and processed food loaded with preservatives. You'll eat far more fresh fruits and vegetables, fresh meats, and whole grains. Educate your taste buds to enjoy food as God made it. Train yourself to enjoy whole foods for desserts, fruits and nuts, for example, and healthier desserts, cakes and cookies with whole flours and whole sweeteners. The more you eat them instead of processed junk food, the more you'll enjoy them. When we eat whole foods, our bodies assimilate nutrients better. For example, what happens when you eat whole grain, whole wheat? Well, the outside of the wheat kernel, the bran and the germ, that contains almost all of the vitamins, minerals, and enzymes, helps you digest the starchy part, the endosperm, within. What happens when you eat wheat that has been refined? Your body still needs those vitamins, minerals, enzymes to digest the starchy part, but they've been removed. Only the starchy part remains. This means that your body has to pull those vitamins, minerals, and enzymes from your own bones, tissues, and organs in order to digest it. When you eat a refined product, not only are you missing out on the wonderful nutrients God created in it, you're actually robbing your body of those nutrients. Whole foods give you nutrients. Man-made counterfeits take nutrients from you. Eat whole wheat rather than refined flour, whole grain pasta, brown rice rather than white rice, whole fruits and vegetables with the skins. Don't let the cacophony of conflicting nutritional advice confuse you. Start simple. Eat whole foods. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. Send us your comments on the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Richard Palmer. Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with this thought from John Wayne. Tomorrow is the most important thing in life. It comes into us at midnight very clean. It's perfect when it arrives and puts itself in our hands. It hopes we've learned something from yesterday. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.